Johann Sebastian Bach is a daunting topic, I know. But we'll try to take a fresh look into the life and work of this great musician and man of faith who ended his manuscripts with the inscription, Soli Deo Gloria, to God alone be the glory. Over the next 4 weeks, we'll look at Bach as a practicing German Lutheran who worked tirelessly as a professional musician and dedicated his creative output to the God who blessed him with an extraordinary gift of music. We'll start with a brief overview of Bach's life. The handout gives you a timeline with many more details than we have time to cover, so you might find it helpful as a reference for all four sessions. The map on the last page shows some of the towns and cities where Bach lived and visited. We'll have discussion time at the end of the hour, but please feel free to stop me if you have a question. The Bach family had been professional musicians for generations, so Sebastian Bach was destined to have music at the center of his life. But unlike his forebears, he took his craft to a new level of beautiful art that has endured and continues to reach people, Christian and not, all over the world. Two important threads run throughout Bach's life: Martin Luther, along with his theology, and the pipe organ. First, the all-important Luther element in Bach's life, both Luther the person and the Lutheran faith. Bach's life was shaped from his youngest years by a connection to Martin Luther. Bach was born in 1685 in the town of Eisenach, in the part of Germany known as Thuringia, represented on your map by Weimar. Eisenach is literally in the shadow of the mountain retreat known as the Wartburg, where Luther translated the New Testament into German in the early 1520s. And here is the Wartburg today. Also, as a boarding student, Luther attended the same grammar school as Bach would 200 years later. In Eisenach, the presence of Luther was strong, and it still is today, even in our much more secular world. When Bach's parents died before his 10th birthday, Bach may have felt an exceptional closeness to Luther as a spiritual father figure. And Bach may have maintained this special connection, drawing strength from it through adulthood. Scholars have discussed the possibility at length, and whether or not it's true, we know that Bach studied the writings of Luther over the course of his entire life, and his library contained many volumes of Luther and other Lutheran authors. Bach also made generous use of the hymns of Luther and his contemporaries in both organ and vocal works. These were the first classic Reformation hymns we call chorales, created so that the Lutheran congregation could sing and truly participate in worship. After all, the singing congregation was a major liturgical piece of the Reformation, including John Calvin. By Bach's time, these chorales were old, but they were still sung in worship, serving to teach Lutheran doctrines. After Luther died, hymn writing continued to flourish in Germany, and Bach also incorporated these later chorales into his church music. Today, the term Bach chorale brings to our ears Bach's unmatched harmonizations of chorales that concluded many of his cantatas. While Bach didn't write new chorales, with very few exceptions, he chose to honor these traditional songs of the Lutheran people by setting them to beautiful and often intricate four-part harmony, as in the cantata chorales. Our Presbyterian hymnal includes 13 hymns harmonized by Bach. Three are repeats with different text. They are all, in my opinion, spiritually and musically rewarding to sing in worship. Bach also used chorale tunes in a wide variety of organ chorales, where the tune served as the framework and inspiration for Bach's creativity. He took a similar approach to cantata movements based on chorales. We'll hear this on October 30th when the choir sings the magnificent chorale cantata, Ein Festeburg, A Mighty Fortress. The other enduring thread is the organ, absolutely central to Bach's life. As a child, Sebastian spent time around and in his church's organ, learning how it worked. And of course, he learned to play. He also played the violin and other keyboard instruments, harpsichord, clavichord, and later even forte piano. But his primary instrument was the pipe organ. He became renowned as an organ consultant during the building of organs, as well as a tester of new organs. Part of the testing included a virtuoso recital. In fact, Bach gained primary fame during his life as a virtuoso organist, unmatched by any other player. As for organ composition, he composed the bulk of his organ music early in his career, then late in life, when he was no doubt contemplating his legacy, he returned to the organ with new works and old ones revised. Bearing these ideas in mind, let's look at some key points in Bach's life. After Bach's parents died, Sebastian and his older brother lived with their eldest brother, Christoph, in the nearby town of Ohrdruf. What's significant about this period is keyboard study. Christoph had studied with the esteemed Johann Pachelbel, and he passed along what he had learned to his brother. The musical education yielded greater prospects than if Bach had apprenticed to his violinist father. Surely a blessing in disguise. We can tell that Bach thoroughly absorbed the central and southern German styles of organ music. It wasn't typically complex, and obbligato pedals were not the rule, but the music was very appealing. Bach also studied and copied the manuscripts of composers from other areas of Germany and from other countries. This was largely how he learned his craft. And Bach attended excellent schools throughout his youth. His education included Latin, theology, singing, and music theory. In 1700, when Bach was 15, his musical world expanded. He traveled north, walking with a fellow classmate to the town of Lüneburg, near the great Hanseatic city of Hamburg. There he attended the school attached to St. Michael's Church as a chorister for 2 years. He then spent more time in Lüneburg, possibly as an apprentice to the famous organist and composer Georg Böhm, based at St. John's Church across town. We don't know the details of this period. Bach never kept a journal and wrote few letters. But it's likely that Bach studied organ with Böhm and also traveled to Hamburg to hear the opera, which was Italian in style, as well as the many impressive organs of the city. He no doubt heard the playing of the great organist Johann Adam Reinken, known for his flamboyant and virtuosic playing. Surely Bach also heard the orchestra from the French-style court of Celle near Lüneburg. You can easily imagine how many musical ideas Bach absorbed during this period. Then, in late 1702, Bach returned to Thuringia and got a short-term job as a lackey at the Weimar court, where he got to know the musicians and the schedule of court life. In July of 1703, at the age of 18, Bach was hired to inspect and assess a newly built organ for the new church in the town of Arnstadt. Bach so impressed the town and church authorities that he was hired as organist to play the fine new organ. Next slide. Oops. That one. That's the organ he played. This was a very good job for a young musician, and Bach approached it full of ideas and energy. While his youthful exuberance occasionally got him into trouble, today there is a statue of the young Bach outside the new church, now called the Bach Church. It evokes the carefree spirit of a young man. After working dutifully as organist for over 2 years in Arnstadt, Bach asked for a 4-week leave of absence to travel, again on foot and again north, to Lübeck to observe the famous organist and composer Dietrich Buxtehude at work. Buxtehude was famous not only for his impressive organ works with lots of active pedal parts, but for his annual series of large evening church concerts around the season of Advent. These were known as Abendmusiken, or evening musics, and they often featured grand oratorios. So in the Gothic St. Mary's Church in Lübeck, Bach heard church music of the highest quality at regular services and also at the exciting Abendmusiken. So, it's no wonder that Bach overstayed his leave by over 2 months. When he returned to Arnstadt, his employers were not happy. They disciplined Bach, but they did not fire him. The most interesting part about this period, however, is how Bach experimented during worship in increasingly creative ways, most notably in his chorale preludes, which were intended to remind the congregation of the tune it would sing. But often it was nearly impossible for the congregation to pick out the tune from Bach's wild preluding. And of course, people complained. To illustrate, we'll listen to one chorale prelude from this period where the tune isn't as obvious or straightforward as the people expected. The title is Herrgott, nun schließ den Himmel auf. Lord God, now unlock your heaven. The text, written in 1620, is a paraphrase of the Song of Simeon from Luke. It's a reflection on death. You might be surprised to know that this chorale prelude was discovered only in 1985 at, of all places, Yale University. It's part of a manuscript collection of 82 organ chorales compiled in Germany after 1790 by a Mr. Neumeister. It was purchased by the American church musician Lowell Mason in 1852. You know him from the tune To When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. The collection includes 35 chorale preludes of Bach found nowhere else. We now call these the Neumeister Collection. The consensus is that they were composed in Arnstadt, evidence of a young composer at work trying lots of different approaches. Some of the pieces are truly quirky. Many of them are quite lovely and make for pleasant listening. Our example is based on a tune that's not particularly melodic, so you can understand why Bach would dress it up. I'll play it for you. That repeats then. As you listen, notice the fanciful parts and the use of punctuating chords, plunk, plunk, and echoes, features found in both Böhm and Buxtehude. Here's the text to think about as you listen. Lord God, now unlock your heaven. My time is finished, and my soul rejoices. I have toiled and struggled to the end. Send me quickly to my eternal rest. I release all that is on earth. I would rather be in heaven. This is a typical Lutheran idea, the longing for heavenly bliss. The performance you'll hear is on an organ that Bach helped to design in the 1740s. So, an ideal Bach organ sound. Let's hear it. Would you be ready to sing the tune? I don't think so. It's really a fun piece. Bach's tenure in Arnstadt ended in June 1707 when he was appointed organist of St. Blasius Church in nearby Mühlhausen. Next slide. His personal life was also changing as he prepared to marry his distant cousin Maria Barbara in October. Bach was 22, and we assume he was ready to put aside youthful pranks. Bach was also becoming a more ambitious church musician and composer. For example, he composed cantatas whenever the occasion and resources allowed. They demonstrated impressive artistic quality and compositional skill, so much so that at the time, the still young Bach was clearly among the finest contemporary cantata composers. I love the 6 Mühlhausen cantatas. They are original, rich, and filled with variety. We'll listen to a bit of one that isn't often performed now in churches because it was written for the installation of the new town council, which administered church as well as town affairs. The text is mostly sacred, but it does include blessings to the incoming council. The cantata number 71 is lavishly scored because funds were generous for this municipal celebration. And the cantata was even published at the council's expense, a rare occurrence. The title is Gott ist mein König, God is my king or my sovereign. It's a wonderful work, well worth repeated hearings, and it's easy to find on YouTube. We'll hear the opening movement, with trumpets, timpani, recorders, oboes, bassoons, strings, and organ. The text is brief. God is my sovereign since time began. To all men on the earth, their salvation he works. Let's hear it. I don't think that's it. That's it. That's it. Isn't that fun? I just could listen to that all day. I really love that movement. But now to the gentler side of Bach. We'll listen to some of movement 4 of the same cantata, scored for bass voice, flute, oboe, bassoon, cello, and organ. Here's the text. Day and night are thine. Thou makest the sun, the moon, and the stars, as thou bid them, to run duly. For every country here on the earth hast set the borders. You'll hear the words Tag und Nacht, day and night, almost like a lullaby. Let's listen.
Einem jeglichen Lande seine Grenze.
Okay, it goes back to the beginning, so we can stop. But that's two sides of the young Bach writing a cantata. And in a couple of weeks, we'll talk more about cantatas, and you'll hear a little bit of late writing. Even from this early period, we notice colorful instrumentation, not just strings plus some trumpets for excitement. Bach scholar Christoph Wolff makes a convincing argument that Bach, as a composer, thought like an organist. It makes sense because church music and the organ were central in his life. After countless hours spent around organs and organ builders, he knew the organ well. Its architecture with groups of pipes in different sections, how it sounded, and how its distinctive qualities could be transferred to music for other instruments. We see evidence of this perspective throughout Bach's music, but it's especially striking in the instruments chosen for his cantatas, such as the one we just listened to, and in the scoring of his concertos, the famous Brandenburgs being the most obvious example. When you listen, you can almost hear the divisions of the organ in the musical structure. And in the instrumental parts, you recognize the contrasting tonal qualities of organ stops, string, flute, and reed sounds. Once again, we have the organ thread, this time branching beyond playing and inspections. It also gives you something a little different to listen for in Bach. By 1708, Bach and his bride were ready for new challenges. In June, Bach was appointed organist and chamber music at the court in Weimar, where he stayed until late 1717, nearly 10 years. This was a fruitful period for Bach's career and personal life. His first child, a daughter, was born shortly after the move to Weimar. Next week, we'll talk more about the Weimar years, where Bach enjoyed a position that nicely blended church and court life. After Weimar, Bach spent 5 years working at the court of Prince Leopold in Köthen, in the area of Saxony, whose center was Dresden. This court was Calvinist, with its spare worship and music limited to psalm singing. Organ works were certainly not needed, and cantatas were called for rarely. Bach did compose some dramatic pieces, much like secular cantatas or chamber operas, but he focused on instrumental music, including concertos, sonatas for various instruments, keyboard works, etc. Officially, Bach provided music for entertainment in an elegant court setting. Artistically, he used these years to perfect his personal musical style. While his working life focused on pleasing the prince, his family life continued to revolve around church. The Bachs attended the small Lutheran church in town, ironically built with funds from Prince Leopold's mother, who wasn't sympathetic to the Reformed tradition. From all reports, this was a happy, creative time for Bach, until his wife died suddenly in 1720 while Bach was out of town with the prince. Maria Barbara's death was, of course, difficult for Bach and his four children. In his grief, Bach soon considered other positions, at first perhaps to get away from memories. He auditioned for a prominent organist job in Hamburg. He was the favored candidate, but withdrew. Meanwhile, back at the Curtain Court, support for music was weakening. The prince was set to marry a woman who disliked music. So Bach continued to look for a new opportunity while he was also looking for a new wife. He found the latter first. Anna Magdalena Wilke, age 20, was a soprano at the court. Women could sing at courts, but not at churches with Latin school choirs. The two married in December of 1721, and Anna Magdalena continued to sing at court, making a very good salary. About a year later, Bach applied to be cantor of St. Thomas Church in Leipzig, also in Saxony. The Leipzig authorities were thrilled to offer Bach the position, which included teaching duties at the church Latin school and directing the music programs at the four major city churches. Bach, then 38, and his family moved to Leipzig in May of 1723. He remained in the position for 27 years until his death. In 2 weeks, we'll talk more about the Leipzig years when Bach produced the bulk of his concerted vocal music, that is, music for voices and instruments. These years were also the most professionally demanding of Bach's life. He had a grueling schedule, and yet he always chose to work harder than was required in order to perform the very best church music. In both his teaching and his composing, Bach maintained the same Lutheran goals he grew up with. As stated in the school's regulations, to teach students in the knowledge and fear of God and in the vivid knowledge of divine essence and will. God was still at the center of Bach's life and work. I'll stop now for some questions before moving on to Bach and his family. Surely you have some questions. He had a total of 20, but only 10 lived beyond childhood. He really suffered more losses than most people did at the time, even though death was fairly common. Some people say that Bach just simply was unlucky and had a lot of tragedy in his life, from losing his parents to losing his first wife and losing so many children. And also he was close to death because he was a church musician, and so he played for many, 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 many funerals. And he wrote lots of music that was appropriate for funerals, especially organ music, like the piece we heard today. And in these Neumeister chorales, a number of them are appropriate for funerals. So, yeah.
As a non-musician,
yeah,
I'm often just wonder at musicians like Bach who come up with new ideas that no one ever had before. And I'm just wondering how that happens.
I think it's a gift of God. Well, Bach was exceptionally talented, but he was also very driven, and he worked at it. I think almost any musician who's excelled and is at the top of whatever they're doing, whether it's performing or composition, will tell you that a lot of it is simply the desire to be creative and to work very, very hard. He was incredibly driven. I think from the point of a young child, he would copy all this music from composers from Italy and France and learn from it. And then he took what he learned and tweaked it his own way and created on top of that. But he had a wonderful foundation to begin with, because the 17th century saw this amazing blossoming of musical composition in the brand new Baroque style, so different from the Renaissance, which was beautiful, but simply, I guess, in many ways, not as exciting to our ears. Didn't have as many instruments. It didn't have as dramatic representation of text. So he was building on a long tradition. I mean, you can tell I love the 17th century. I mean, this is obvious. If you've ever gone to church, you know I play a lot of Buxtehude and Böhm and all these other composers. But it helps me understand where Bach learned his craft. And that's why I highly recommend listening to 17th century music. Yes?
The late.
He was late. He was at the end, yes. And before he died, the Baroque was really over.
So was his, when you listen to Bach, you listen to it and you know, you can tell who it is, but what is there about that? Is it the harmonies that are so unusual? Because his music is identifiable, even to a novice.
It is. Well, I think he did have his unique musical language. And we're going to talk next week about how he developed that. When you listen to Handel, he's recognizable too, isn't he? I think you're just learning his language, his musical language. And Handel, in contrast to Bach, I mean, they were total contemporaries, although they never met. They came very close to meeting, but never met. They each admired the other's works, but of course, Handel spent plenty of time in Italy and then the rest of his life in England. He had totally different priorities, and he focused on music for the public and music that amateurs could play, whereas Bach aimed a little bit higher. His music was more complex and more sophisticated. As much as we all love Handel, you realize that Bach is very, very different. And I just think it's his unique musical language. But they both fell at the end of the Baroque, which we say it began in 1600 and ended in 1750. But nothing happens boom, boom. Yeah. Eric.
Yeah, did he borrow from any musical traditions that were other than Germanic?
That's, as I mentioned, he studied the music of French composers, Italian composers. He heard Italian-style opera in Hamburg. He heard French-style music at the court near Lüneburg. Absolutely. And Italian style was all the rage, and then the French style became more and more popular, and so he actually wrote for harpsichord Italian suites and French suites, but he also just incorporated it into his own music. Yeah. Even though he didn't travel a lot, he was very much aware of what was going on in the world. Okay, well, let's talk about his family a little bit, and then we'll still have plenty of time for discussion. We don't know much about Bach's domestic life, but all reports, especially from the Leipzig years, indicate a busy household, hospitable to guests, with plenty of musical instruments, good food, drink, and stimulating conversation. Frequent guests included prominent musical figures, both composers and performers, often from out of town. Bach's son, Carl Philipp Emanuel, whose godfather was the composer Telemann, reported that while his father had no time for lengthy correspondence, he had instead, quote, more opportunity to talk personally to good people, since his house was like a dovecot and just as full of life. Association with him was pleasant for everyone and often very edifying. Since he never wrote down anything about his life, the gaps are unavoidable. End quote. In Leipzig, Bach had a spacious apartment in the school building next to the church. As cantor, Bach had an office suite with composing studio, a heated corner room with large windows, and an adjacent chamber as additional workspace. Nearby was the school's music library, where much of the music copying likely took place, often at a frantic pace to prepare for a performance. Think Saturday morning, Saturday afternoon, Sunday's coming up. Copyists included Anna Magdalena, the children, older students, and others. Copying musical scores was a necessary skill in this time. The household usually included an apprentice, studying with Bach and working as a copyist. Bach's cousin served as secretary and live-in tutor for the youngest boys. Evenings often included leisurely dinners and then music making before Bach would retreat to his composing studio with a bottle of brandy. It sounds lovely, yet with all this fun, Bach had to maintain a tough schedule. His workday began at 5 a.m., 6 in the winter. The family suffered multiple losses of children from both marriages. In this era, death was always near, and although lots of children died, the grief was still strong. The Bachs also had other family trials. One son was developmentally slow, although apparently very musical. Another son was smart and talented, but unfortunately a ne'er-do-well who died in his 20s. Three of the sons had successful careers as musicians: the Dresden Bach, Wilhelm Friedemann, the Berlin Bach, Carl Philipp Emanuel, and the London Bach, Johann Christian, the youngest son. Less is known about the daughters, but they probably received a good education at home, even though the Latin school and university were closed to them. Regarding singing, Bach mentioned in a rare letter that his oldest daughter joins in not badly. The daughters lived ordinary lives, the youngest surviving into old age, but only one of the four married. Sad to say, almost nothing is known about first wife Maria Barbara, although she did come from a musical family. We know a bit more about Anna Magdalena, who married Sebastian on a Wednesday so that all the musician guests would be sober and ready to perform by Sunday. Judging from the invoice of the wine purchased, we can imagine lots of celebrating with friends and family. We know that Anna Magdalena had a beautiful, clear soprano voice, and she probably continued her singing career in a limited way after the move to Leipzig. Outside of music and household duties, she liked a garden and was partial to yellow carnations. She also liked birds, especially linnets, little finch-like songbirds. We assume that she assisted in musical matters, copying for sure, teaching the daughters, perhaps offering her opinions, which Bach must have found helpful. In contrast, Telemann's wife and mother of his 9 children was a compulsive gambler who also ran around with other men. Let's turn now to Bach's reputation for getting into trouble with his superiors. How did Bach deal with authorities? The answer is not very well. In personal and family matters, he behaved with dignity and restraint, but he could be feisty and difficult when the subject was his art. Bach took his profession very seriously, and he was always careful to nurture his career. I think we're hearing a joyful noise to the Lord outside. He was competitive and definitely wanted to make a name for himself, so he always fought for his art. Bach's primary goal for his art was to have a well-regulated, Bach's term, church music. He articulated this way back in Mühlhausen. In other words, Bach wanted the finest of church music. He no doubt had similar high goals for his secular music, and he clearly got much pleasure and satisfaction from all his music. Through the years, he consistently aimed higher, embracing challenges from writing and performing truly virtuosic music to the musical puzzles that we can't really hear, but we can see on the page. He continued to strive for the very best until the end of his life. But what was he like as a person? Despite his large family, convivial social life, and busy professional life, Bach seems to have been an essentially private person. We simply don't know what he was thinking. The best clues are in his music. The more works we listen to, the more we can sense the spirit of Bach. Unless we turn Bach into a myth, we must remember that he was a normal person, working and taking care of his family. And we're pretty sure that he relied on his strong faith in God, nurtured by Luther's teachings, to get through year after year of hard work. That's enough from me. Let's have some discussion. I'm ready. Surely you have more questions. There's so much to talk about. I just picked and chose a few things. Yes.
How would you compare compare Bach with, say, Mozart in terms of personality?
Oh, well, Mozart was very outgoing. They were just completely different. Although Mozart admired Bach a great deal. And Mozart was a child prodigy, and his father took him touring and performed for people all over the world. I would say they are just completely different. And Mozart, while he was a Catholic, a Roman Catholic, and he did write some church works, you don't get the sense that his devotion to God was that deep. Yes?
Musically, various church traditions. I think the Lutheran church today, you sort of listen around, it seems to me that their music is richer and more, the choral music in the Lutheran church. Is that?
It's a legacy. Yeah, yeah. It's Luther. It's Luther. Luther loved music, and he made it a key part of his Reformation. That's why he focused so on the chorales and the people singing, but also art music. He wanted the very best of music in church. He was quite generous, and that's why all the way through, and including in Bach's time, you would hear instrumental works in music. For example, at communion, you would hear a sonata or chamber works with instruments, as well as chorales and other pieces. And that's why you hear these rather elaborate cantatas. Luther would have absolutely loved that. But other composers did it too. Yep. Like St. Olaf? Yeah. Yeah. They keep it going, and my Lutheran friends tell me that the hymn singing is great in their churches. And when I visit, that's true. Did you have a question? Somebody over here? He didn't go to university. So he finished. When he finished, basically, we would say high school, but compared to our education, that would be the equivalent of college. It was pretty good. And then he studied. He studied and studied. Christoph Wolff, who's one of the major Bach scholars of the 20th century and moving into the 21st, wrote the definitive biography of Bach. And he titled it Johann Sebastian Bach, The Learned Musician. So he was largely self-taught as a musician. And he did get a good education, but he kept it going. We would call it lifelong learning. He was sophisticated. He would make, in his music library, he had this huge music library, including the complete works of Martin Luther. He would make notations in the margins of his annotated Bible and of all these other works. And he was very much involved in choosing which poetic text would be used in cantatas and things like that. So I think he had a good education. Yes, Paul.
Did he collaborate with anyone for the librettos?
He used... Librettos tended to be published for cantatas, and so he often used those, and he did collaborate with some depending on when it was in his career. When he was in Weimar, he knew the poet whose librettos he used. So who knows? And there's some we don't know the librettist. So you might think, oh, did Bach do it himself? There's no evidence that he did, but who knows? Sandy?
Could you speak a little bit about the relationship he had with the town councils where he lived?
Yeah. Often there was bureaucracy. And that was the trade-off of the court where things were often unstable. And the town council was basically in charge of the church. And you could see the bureaucracy that would be there. So that almost sets up problems. And yes, Bach was always fussing with them because he didn't have enough money for performers, or they wouldn't support this, or they wouldn't support that. But ultimately, he just managed to get through it. I don't think it really got in the way of his art, and after all, he stayed in Leipzig for 27 years. So, fussing a lot, but, yeah.
Could you compare the German Protestant music at that time to the Catholic practices?
Yeah, the truth is the style was pretty much the same, and especially in the generations leading up to Bach, even more so. The musical style was essentially the same style you found in the secular world, in opera. And opera was, especially for vocal music, was very influential. Notice in these cantatas we have arias, like you have arias in opera. So that was extremely influential on both the Catholics and the Protestants. The main difference would be the text, because the Catholics would have their Marian text. But interestingly enough, because the Italian style was so popular, you would get some pieces coming up from Italy, especially in the 17th century, and the Protestant church people wanted to use them in worship. So they would substitute Jesus for Mary. They'd take out Mary and put Jesus' name there. And so, like, you know, Ave Jesus kind of thing. And then they would use it. But the music was essentially the same. It depended on where it was. A different period. But by the 17th century, there was concerted music with instruments. And just depending on where it was, if you had a court, and in Germany there were a few Catholic courts, and that's where you would get rather elaborate music. Maybe not so much in the smaller churches, because Catholicism was in certain areas of Germany. It wasn't everywhere. And where Bach lived, it wasn't strong. In Leipzig, there was a small Catholic church. And I mean, very tiny, very few people came, except during the trade fairs. There were three big trade fairs every year, and lots of visitors came from out of town, and they would come to Bach's church and all the other Protestant churches, and they would also come to the Catholic church, especially if they'd come up from Italy.
What fascinates you so much about the 17th century, or what is it that was there that is not there in the subsequent centuries?
Oh, I think it's just, I think a spirit of experimentation and music that is very, very much tied to the emotions. It's very expressive music. And the forms of it aren't very long. Pieces tend to be fairly compact, and they're organized into sections instead of movements. And I guess I have a modern brain, but I don't get bored. And if you don't like one section, another one's coming up. But yet they're very well organized and planned out. But it's like the antithesis of a Bruckner symphony, where you're just sitting for a long, long time to get through one movement. So they're on a smaller scale as far as length, but sometimes the scale of instruments can be huge. They would write pieces for lots and lots of instruments and double choirs and all kinds of things like that, and they were grand and glorious. So that's another thing I like. Yes?
Well, the principalities had a lot to do with politically.
Oh, yeah. And they would switch. Sometimes one would be Catholic, and then somebody else would come into power, and they would switch it back to Protestant. And there was a lot of fussing going on, and lots of wars, and lots of conflicts. And that's why I think ultimately Bach chose the church life as the lesser of two evils. So that's a very, very good point. And we'll talk more about court life next week. In Weimar, that was an unusual court. Yes?
Would it be possible for a Bach to be as productive in our contemporary world with so many distractions?
Makes you wonder, doesn't it? But think of all the distractions he had with his busy household, all his children, his heavy workload. He always worked hard. So I can only think that he would be okay. Yeah, Donna.
Did he have any students?
Oh, lots and lots of students. Yes, he was always teaching. And he was a well-known teacher, and he liked to teach. This was one of the things he loved to do, and that's one reason he had apprentices who would come to study with him. Some of them did, a few, but not a, you wouldn't recognize their names, probably. His sons became well-known, and, of course, they studied with him. And they were all different. Each son went on a different path musically. The youngest son, who settled in London, really never talked about his father much. Of course, old Bach was old by the time he was born, and the styles had completely changed. It was the classical era, and he just didn't have much to do with his Bach music from the past. We still have time for one or two more questions. Don't have anything? Yeah.
Paul's legacy.
Yeah.
It's my understanding that there was a period of time after his death where really a lot of his music was not played.
That's true. After his death, in the fourth week, we're going to talk about Bach's legacy, and we'll get more into this. But it is very interesting that after his death, a lot of his music just went out of favor, mostly the cantatas, because the style was simply old-fashioned. What did last and never went away was his keyboard works, and especially in sophisticated circles of learned people, they would buy the works that Bach had printed, and or they would pass things down in manuscript, and they would study it. For example, Mozart and Beethoven and Brahms, they all did. But even shortly after Bach died, they kept this amazing legacy of keyboard works that showed complexity, intelligence. They knew that this was old, but something special. Because when you got to the classical period, with the exception of fine composers like Haydn and Mozart, the music was kind of simplistic. It focused on tunes, and it was a little bit, for Bach lovers, it would have been shallow. But you know how times change. But real composers thought, this Bach is worth studying. So that stayed. Yeah. And we'll talk more about that the last week. And the last week, Sandy Connolly will be our guest to talk about legacy work even now. Yes, Eric.
Was there any particular aristocrat or duke who had special influence in music?
Not any special one. The dukes in Weimar were very supportive of Bach, so that helped. Prince Leopold was, and even after Bach left, he was the official court composer. He kept these networks going, and we'll talk more about that next week. But nobody in the way you're thinking. Nobody, yeah. But Bach was always keeping his connections going with courts.
Very quick. What musical thing is he holding in his hand in that picture, do you know?
I think it's a canon, which is a canon, which is like a round, but a complicated canon. I think from the Art of the Fugue. I'm not sure. Art of Fugue, so. Yeah. Well, I think we've run out of time, so I hope to see you next week.